You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The retrospective of Martin Puryear's sculptures currently at the Museum of Modern Art includes 47 works created over the past 30 years. The reviews have been glowing. For example, Roberta Smith of the New York Times writes that his work slows you down and makes you consider its every detail as physical fact, artistic choice, and purveyor of meaning. I'm very pleased that this beautiful exhibit has brought both Mr. Puryear and its organizer, John Elderfield, Museum of Modern Art's chief curator of painting and sculpture, to the show today. Hello.
Hello.
Howdy.
Martin, has putting together this show forced you to think about the connections between the older and the newer pieces?
Well, any time you do a survey of work that spans a number of years, for me at least, it's always educational, revealing, shows you what you've been doing, even as on a day-to-day basis you may not be conscious of what you're doing. You're simply conscious of what you're doing that given moment or that given week or that given month, what your preoccupation is. But looking at a span of work that that covers, I think this actually goes back close to 33 years, you really realize what you were doing in a larger sense. And it's reinforcing. It's very reinforcing to me of the notion that I did have a project, even though I'm not conscious of having a major overarching project as I work day to day.
Because you're just concentrating on the work
yes.
that you're doing, and then
yes.
only later when you say, hey, what am I going to pick out for a show,
yes.
that you realize, oh, there are certain themes yeah. that I return to.
Right. This came to me very, very clearly when I saw the atrium installed, the second floor atrium, which...
Because this is on a couple of floors.
Well, the show is on two floors. It's on the atrium. There's a large... a very tall space on the atrium, and then there's the bulk of the show, the rest of the 40-some pieces on the sixth floor. And the atrium had, I think there's five works, mm-hmm. four quite large. And they span, they go back to 1970, I think the earliest is about 76, 77, and it goes, the last piece, the most recent piece, was just done days before the show was picked up from my studio. And it was... I think a very pleasant surprise for me to realize that, in fact, that the works held together. These five pieces that were collected together for that installation held together as works by a single hand, a single mind.
Most of the pieces are made of wood. What is it about wood that appeals to you?
Well,
because wood is the most fragile of all sculptural materials, isn't it? One of the reasons we don't have a sense of what was going on in Africa 300 years ago, for example, is because so much of the work is done in wood and eventually it deteriorates.
That's certainly true of African sculpture. It's less true in places where there was a drier and less hostile climate to wood, for example, in Egypt. There's a lot of material that comes out of ancient Egypt, furniture and wood sculpture from Egypt and places. But it's true. It is a place, it is a material that is... fragile as far as natural encroachment for insects and fungus and things like that. That's why when I do work outdoors, I tend to do work in anything but wood, bronze or stainless steel and granite. But the reason I work in wood, if I can have a conscious reason, is just because it's something I learned to manipulate even before I was an artist. And it's a material I know. I have a sense of the vast range of things you can do with it. I like the fact that it does connect back through history and to a lot of different cultures. And as a material, it has as deep and broad a legacy in utilitarian non-fine art artifacts and objects as it does in the fine arts.
And wood has as much variation as stone does. There are
Absolutely.
Soft woods, hard woods, dark woods, light woods. How do you wind up choosing one or the other? Do you sometimes find a piece of wood you like, a tree branch or a piece of burl, and then bring it to your studio and wait until you find the right use for it?
That's exactly what happens sometimes, but not always. More typically, I will have an idea and then decide on what kind of material I will use to realize it, including wood and maybe other materials. I've done work in other materials.
Wire mesh, tar, rawhide.
Exactly. So the choice of what material to use depends on the form, the shape, what I need it to do in terms of strength, of tensile strength, carvability, resistance to checking or cracking from humidity changes. All these things are facts that are taken into consideration. They're technical facts. They're not artistic bases for a choice, but that's the basis on which I choose what material.
John, have you been aware of Martin's work from the earliest days?
Perhaps not from the earliest days, but from right at the end of the 70s. And I remember very clearly an exhibition in Chicago which had the Beckwith piece in its form with the Beckwith piece is a long rawhide, multiple strands of rawhide. And in that iteration, it had two sculptural objects attached to it as well. And so I've sort of followed it since then. And then about 15 years ago, it turned out that Martin and I were living upstate about 15 minutes from each other, so we got to know each other more then. But of course, it's a different issue when you're actually working together as having been friends. And for me, it's been a great experience to really get a fuller sense of what the work is.
I remember driving down to see a major retrospective of Martin's work at the Philadelphia Museum some years back. Why has it taken so long for a show like this to be mounted in New York?
Well, it's interesting that, I mean, the last big one was Chicago in 91. Is that right?
Yeah,
early 90s. And
which traveled to three other museums.
Yeah.
Hirshhorn Museum, the Museum of Contemporary Art Los Angeles, and the Philadelphia Museum. It's where you saw it.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I did have a show, a survey, I think it was in the early 80s, which came to the new museum when it was on Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Downtown.
Downtown. Mm-hmm. But that was, again, almost a quarter century ago now.
Yep.
It's hard to believe.
Yep. So it's certainly been, you know, something which we've wanted to do for a while. And my predecessor at the museum, Kirk Barnardo, was someone who very much wanted to see this. And when, after Kirk passed away and I became chief curator, it was something which I wanted to do too. And I remember driving up to Martin and saying, you know, let's get this on the schedule. And here we are. And
well, you have new larger galleries upstairs than you did in the past. In the old days, you would have had to shove this in the basement and it would have felt cramped. And now there's a lot of air around the sculpture.
Absolutely. And I think that it's interesting that the galleries have been open about 3 years. And, you know, it's like being in a house. It takes a while to get used to the spaces and everything. But I have to say, I think that the galleries have never looked better than they look at present, and particularly the atrium, which is so absolutely transformed by these big sculptures.
Well, people will be surprised by the contrast with the last major sculptural exhibit that you had, Richard Serra's exhibit. I don't know whether you see similarities because you are a carver, among other things, mm-hmm. and he has works like many other contemporary sculptors. He comes up with an idea, and then a foundry makes it. You mm-hmm. For you, Martin, it seems really important to be the person who actually does all the sculpting. But it's a matter of process for you, isn't it?
It is. It's a matter of process from the very beginning in most cases. And I am fundamentally a maker. I mean, in the physical sense, in the literal physical sense, I think. And I think that I also have a predisposition to working with space in ways that are not about colonizing a huge amount of museum real estate or ground or space, but just trying to think of ways to make a very compressed, intensely focused form in space. That seems to be much closer to my own way of thinking about things. And I actually construct more than carve, to be more accurate. I tend not to do a lot of carving of monolithic blocks, but I tend to make pieces by putting elements together into.
And I think it's interesting, you know, what Martin said earlier about how his particular technique relates also, I mean, not only to the history of earlier sculpture in different cultures, but also to the history of use objects. And I think that...
Like furniture,
like
because...
Like furniture, like boats, like, you know, and I think that one of the ways that the sculpture gains this sense of condensation is that, on the one hand, it is somewhat reminiscent of these kind of use objects, and so that you have a very physical relationship with it in that way. And then you realize, of course, you're walking around and the views change and the surprises take place, which don't happen with ordinary use things.
We'll get into that in more detail after we take a little break. My guests are Martin Puryear, whose sculpture is now being given a major retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art. John Elderfield is here. He is MoMA's chief curator of painting and sculpture and the organizer of the exhibit, or one of the organizers, because I suspect this was a huge project. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Martin Puryear. A major retrospective is currently on view at the Museum of Modern Art. It runs through January 14th of next year. Also with us is John Elderfield, MoMA's chief curator of painting and sculpture. Martin, you grew up in Washington, D.C. Had you always wanted to be an artist?
I think I had, actually. I think I'd always been an artist. I think when I was a child, I drew and painted from a very early age. My parents, fortunately, were encouraging from the very beginning.
But you wanted to be a painter initially.
Well, I had a clearer grasp of what being a painter was than being a sculptor, although I built things while I was in school studying painting in undergraduate years at Catholic University. And it wasn't until I had come out of undergraduate years, done a couple of years abroad in different places, and then come back to by the time I came back to do my graduate studies, I was pretty clearly interested in not making images of things, but making the things themselves. And at that point, I began to put my impulse to build and construct together with a notion of making sculptures, and that's where the work evolved.
Well, there was a time when painters had contempt for sculpture. I remember Ad Reinhardt used to say that sculpture is the stuff that you bump into when you're backing up to get a better look at the painting. But that's all changed. In fact, I think the 60s pretty much changed that. You were in the Peace Corps, weren't you, after you went to college?
Right.
Went to Sierra Leone. Did you specifically choose to go to that part of Africa?
It wasn't a choice. One was assigned. And I was very gratified when I was assigned there to go to West Africa. I thought I might have been sent to a French-speaking country because I had studied French in high school and college.
But Sierra Leone was a former
Sierra Leone
British
was a
colony.
Former British colony, but I ended up as a teacher of French there. I ended up teaching French to secondary school kids along with biology and English, and had an art club as well.
Were you already interested in African sculpture?
I had been as an undergraduate student. I had been, and I have to say that when I was in Sierra Leone, I didn't see a whole lot of what I would call important tribal art there. That was not something that a Westerner would see in its context very well. These are ritual objects that are pretty much reserved for use by the people in the tribe. What you would see would be stuff that would be brought to your door for sale by traders, and often it would be degraded material that wasn't carved in the highest form or for the original purpose, and you'd also see work at the airport gift shops of the same type.
Yeah, but the greatest African art was designed not to just as sculpture, but and as for its aesthetics, although that's really important, but for some other practical purposes.
Right.
I suspect that was something that had an influence on you, that thinking.
Well, I was in contact with a lot of artisans, people who made things for use, skilled people in the community who occasionally would be called upon to make ritual objects. I saw carvers who were making things for use, and they also, as a side part of their life, would make a mask from time to time. But I saw a lot of potters. I saw whole villages where the entire population was given over to making pots. I saw leather workers and blacksmiths and weavers. Weaving tradition there was pretty extraordinary. and to see, to be living in a place where there was still this manual connection to the useful object was revelatory for me.
And you studied as well with local carpenters in the village.
I don't know if I'd say studied. I lived among them. We exchanged. I was making guitar when I was there, and the head carpenter in our town who made all our furniture for our school was very curious. So we exchanged information. So he built a guitar with me, and also people were very curious to see me make boats. I had built a kayak there, which was for the people there just amazing that you can make a boat out of a canvas instead of hollowing it out of a tree. And it would float, and they stood on their banks amazed when he put in water, and it floated down the river and didn't sink. So there was a lot of exchange both ways. But I did live among people who worked with no machinery,
and that's important. No power tools, actually, exactly. No electricity, so they couldn't have.
Exactly.
So is that something that you have continued?
I have the machines I need. I have enormous. I make enormous use of hand tools. I think that's my preferred way to work, but certainly in this century, in this time, you do have to let yourself use machinery just to be efficient.
And then you went to Sweden, to the Royal Swedish Academy of Art. Of all the countries in the world, I can't think of one great artist who came out of Sweden.
Oh, well, there's
Norway, yes. Denmark,
Klaus,
yes.
Klaus Oldenburg is Swedish.
Born in Sweden?
I think he might have been.
Okay, well, I think of it as an American artist.
Yeah, yeah.
So why did you go there?
I went there. I was interested in going to Scandinavia for a long time, partly because of their social sort of policy, the whole enlightened social sort of policy that they seem to have there. I was also interested in the material culture in the north, the sort of the... furniture tradition that existed in Denmark and Sweden, which was connected, even though it was an industrialized entity now, it was still rooted in the craft tradition, especially in Denmark. So that was something I was very curious to see. The whole design tradition in Scandinavia in the 60s was very, very strong. And also, I've always been drawn to the north, to northern culture.
From Africa to Sweden.
Yes. So I did trips up to Lapland and above the Arctic Circle in Sweden and hiked and backpacked. And so it was a whole cultural draw that I had a curiosity about.
In a statement that's posted at the beginning of the show, you say, "I value the referential quality of art, the fact that a work can allude to things or states of being without in any way representing them." And people do walk around the galleries and they, even though these are abstract works, they say, oh, that's a head or that's something else. In one case, very specifically, that's a ladder because you have made a ladder. But does that bother you that they see things in your abstract work?
I think that's a human reaction to abstract work. I think people tend to want to. I mean, I get asked the question a lot: what is it of? What is it supposed to be? And I think for people who have followed the history of art, the developments in art, and the evolution of thinking in art, they can more readily look at a piece of abstract art and see it for what it is, and not have to see what it's supposed to be derived from. And people who don't have that connection to the history. Need to, you know, their tendency is to want to find representational things in it. The fact is that my most recent work, I've actually found myself using quite literal objects. You mentioned the ladder. There's also the cart that's part mm-hmm. of the large piece in the atrium, and also the wheelbarrow that with a carved mask, a representation of a mask from Africa that makes up that ensemble. So.
But an artist who I feel you have certain affinities with, Brancusi, also would, I mean, he did a famous piece at the Museum of Modern Art, John, mm-hmm. Bird in Flight.
Yep.
We see the bird in flight, even though it's a perfectly abstract piece. Where would you place Martin in relation to other contemporary sculptors?
Well, I do think in terms of the referential aspect that, you know, it is indeed true that, you know, that many people, including me, say, well, this is reminiscent of this. It looks like a bird.
Mm-hmm.
But then as you walk around it, it actually changes and it becomes associative of something else. So I think that And there's an element of that in Brancusi, but not to the extent that I think there is in Martin's work. You know, and I think that clearly in the history of sculpture, one thinks of, interestingly, carvers, although, as Martin says, he isn't actually a carver. You know, but one thinks, you know, of Brancusi, one thinks of the mediation of minimalism, you know, and the way in which minimalism was about, you know, in artists like Donald Judd, about creating simple unitary volumes. And I think that, you know, clearly one sees that Martin, you know, didn't go the route of David Smith or a constructor making multiple complicated forms, but really working with condensation and unitary forms. So one thinks of Brancusi, one thinks a little bit of Arp, but you know, at that point one stops. And you know, I really, for me, I mean, this, you know, what Martin has created is, you know, so much his own.
Well, Roberta Smith said, modernism, your work evokes the modernism of Brancusi, Arp, Noguchi, Duchamp, but also carpentry, basket weaving, African sculpture, the building of shelter and ships. And to some degree, you've confirmed that in our conversation. But how important, because this work isn't immediately apparently African-American, how important is that aspect of your life to the work that you've done?
I think it varies. I think it's something that I feel personally, as an artist, you have the freedom to do anything you want with anything that your legacy, which is the legacy of the human race, rather than the legacy of your own ethnographic race. So as a person who was trained and grew up in a culture that's been influenced from all different directions and all periods in history, I feel like I have the freedom to have work that reflects that. I also think that there's a certain truth to the reality that as a Black American, I have a different experience than the white American artists. And So
did you feel that connection to African art? Because there are evocations of African art without being very explicit in the way the French were in the beginning of the 20th century.
Well, there's two parts to that, and one of them relates to the way I felt when I was in Africa. I mean, I felt very privileged to be connected to the place that really gave me the identity that marks my place in this society. As a Black American, you have a certain identity that's very sadly, we as a people can't connect with the way that voluntary immigrants can, because we were brought here involuntarily and our identity or our connection to the old country, if you want to call it that, has been ruptured by the middle passage of the slave trade. So to go back and live among people that could have been my ancestors or neighbors of my ancestors, some of my ancestors, because we're also mixed race people. We're Black Americans. We're not strictly African. We're mixed with European and Native American. So we really are hybridized people. So, but I do feel that it's kind of interesting to allude to my identity occasionally, but I don't think it's something I want to have mark my entire output as an artist. I feel like I have a freedom to embrace a larger world than simply the Black American experience.
Think, you know, looking at Martin's sculptures, clearly there are cases where if one knows about tribal art, will think, yeah, that reminds me of that. But there's also reminiscences of things from very different cultures. And, you know, that, you know, this hasn't come up, but, you know, Martin has, you know, worked in Japan and China and...
And studied falconry, and we see that there as well. But there are some allusions in titles like Ladder for Booker T. Washington and also those two pieces for Jim Beckworth. Mm-hmm. Who was an African American explorer?
He was born, I think, into slavery. His mother was a slave, certainly, but he burst out of his identity and went west. Burst out of the identity that was set up for him by the society at the time, and ran away with some fur traders and went out west, went up to Missouri, and became a scout. And ended up eventually becoming a chief of the Crow Indian tribe in Montana, and was a guide and a Indian scout, and had an amazing life. He's an example of somebody who was not confined by the conditions of his birth.
This show will be at MoMA until January 14th. Will it be traveling after that, John?
Yes, after that it will be in Fort Worth, then at the National Gallery in Washington, and then the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art.
And there's a beautiful catalog with essays by John Elderfield and other curators. It's just a beautiful show, and I want to thank you both so much for being with us, Martin Puryear and John Elderfield. If you can, go to the Museum of Modern Art. If you can't, and I can't imagine why you can't, you can go to our website and see some small pictures of these large, wonderful sculptures. What a pleasure it's been talking to the both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.